I think we're at a moment in time where partnerships between US and international higher ed institutions are really thinking about who holds the power and how those partnerships can be formed in a way where there's more equitable shared power and decision making. A phrase that I like to use and think about, you know, I do work for the US government, so we are promoting, you know, partnerships often between US institutions and our partner countries, but I like to use the phrase of thinking about how can the US institution be the guide on the side rather than the sage on the stage.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, a production of Edu Alliance, a podcast series dedicated to education professionals worldwide. Each episode is a conversation with thought leaders that will enlighten and provide some new thoughts on critical issues facing higher education. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, and thank you for tuning in. I am Senthil Nathan, based in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And with me is my co-host, Dean Hoke, in Bloomington, Indiana. Dean, how are you today? And will you introduce our guest?
Yes, I'm doing very well. It's been a busy day, I think, for all of us. But that's what the fall is all about, new things going on. So let's talk a little bit about our guest today, in which I'm very pleased was able to join us. And her name is Dr. Samantha Alves. She is the Senior Advisor for Higher Education in the Center for Education in USAID, based out of Washington. In her role, she provides technical support to field offices to design activities that engage higher education institutions or post-secondary student populations and works to advance higher education program across sectors within the agency. She has a varied career. She's worked for a number of different international organizations as we go on. She's also been international, meaning that she's also taught and led trips into Namibia and Costa Rica. Interesting places I've never been before. And she is also has her undergraduate and master's in agricultural education at the University of Arizona and her PhD in International Agricultural Development and Agricultural Communications from Texas A&M. Go Aggies. So let's go ahead and begin. And thank you very much for joining us. And you have an interesting and varied career. But Central, why don't you begin?
Sure. Samantha, many developing countries, regions also happen to have large young population. So there is a huge need to equip these bulging youth with Industry 4.0 skills that they need for gainful employment. At the same time, many of these regions have also limitation in the capacity of the brick-and-mortar higher learning institutions. So how can these regions or countries develop their young people through effective deployment of online or blended learning and micro-credentials?
Great. Well, thanks, Senthil and Dean, for inviting me to join you today. I mean, I think this is a really interesting question that no one's really quite cracked the nut on quite yet. You know, higher ed institutions, we are not known to be nimble organizations. And we've been talking about things like massive open online courses or MOOCs in some form or other forms of online learning, you know, for 25, maybe 30 plus years at this point. And I don't think it's really manifested as this one size fits all solution that it was envisioned to be. And then we got hit with COVID-19, right? So that became a real test of that experimentation with online and blended learning. And I think we're finding that it's not the panacea to solving the challenges that we thought it would be. You know, we recently did an evidence summary looking at distance and other forms of blended learning. And one thing we found is that the evidence shows us that this form of online learning doesn't always reduce tuition costs to obtain degrees or certifications or micro-credentialing, which is like a myth, right? We all think, oh, online learning is going to be cheaper than going to a brick and mortar. And then that's, you know, not even talking about the issues or the barriers to access around technology, internet connections, even electricity. I think the other piece is teaching in a blended or online learning environment from a faculty perspective is very different than teaching in the classroom. And we're already at a little bit of a disadvantage college and higher education because our faculty members are often, you know, teaching in higher ed because they're subject matter experts in the field and they don't always have that background in teaching and pedagogical approaches. Yeah, so those are just a few of my thoughts. I think that it's something to add to our higher ed menu in terms of, yes, blended learning can open access for learners who have other commitments at home, can't commit to that brick and mortar education, can't move because they have family or other obligations. But I don't know that it's this like panacea, you know, to solve all things.
Yeah, thanks.
Samantha, let's talk a little bit about USAID and their particular role in the field of higher education in the different regions and the cultures throughout the world. Tell us a little bit about the current focus of USAID, particularly in Higher Education Solutions Network, for example, or Feed the Future, things like that. Talk to us a little bit about that. I don't think a lot of us know really what's going on there.
Well, to start to talk about the present, I'd like to talk a little bit first about the past. You know, USAID and the US government as a whole really has a long history of working in and through higher education. You know, this was really central to the Marshall Plan and the Truman Point Four program and the recovery of Europe after World War II. So we have this long, rich history of working in this space. And in that time frame, you know, 1940s, which is even before USAID was founded in 1961, you know, into like the 1980s, I think our programming was really focused on capacity building. And I'm going to use that word here, building, but you'll hear why I don't use it now in a moment. You know, capacity building. We did a lot of work to create and start higher ed institutions in our partner countries. We did a lot of work that provided scholarship support that brought students to the United States to study. But I think we really started to see a change in our programming. We made those investments. We helped to build and strengthen strong higher ed institutions in many of our partner countries. So you'll see today that our programming is really more focused on locally led development. Higher ed institutions in our partner countries are central actors in locally led development, that they can be taking the lead roles. More and more of our scholarship programming is supporting students to study in their home country or within the region. A challenge with US-based study is always the potential of brain drain. And as there are more high quality higher ed institutions within a region, there is an opportunity to support students to stay in that region, but find, you know, unique aspects like a short-term study abroad, or back to your first question, you know, the connection through distance learning with US students to still have that connection. But to your question on some of our current programming, you know, the role of higher ed institutions, many of the things that you mentioned, the Higher Education Solutions Network, Feed the Future, really focus on the role of higher ed institutions in research and innovation. And I don't think that'll ever not be a focus of our programming. But that's only really one aspect. If we think about at USAID, we have an agency-wide USAID higher education program framework that looks really at the higher ed system and the three core functions of a higher ed system. So research and innovation is definitely one of those core functions. But we also, you know, have that function that focuses on the teaching and learning aspects, reaching students. And I think, you know, the third aspect is one that's not always appreciated, of the role of higher education in their community and connecting, providing services to their local community and creating or establishing networks or participating in networks. So I think you'll see even embedded in these programs like the Higher Education Solutions Network, Feed the Future and Innovation Labs, even that there are these aspects of community engagement. There are these aspects of how they're influencing how faculty members teach. And then back to what I mentioned earlier, you know, all of about building capacity building, I really strive for us to say building implies starting from zero, like starting from scratch. And really, in our programming now, we're capacity strengthening, capacity development. There is always inherently local capacity. So I feel like we should eliminate the word capacity building from our vocabulary and really be thinking more about the strengthening aspect. And as I mentioned, you know, putting those local higher ed institutions in the lead.
Well, let me do a quick follow-up to that. You mentioned two or three different aspects of this, and one of them had been community and higher education. I understand what you're talking about. Can you give me an example or two that might help our listeners get a better focus on what that may mean?
Sure. You know, so the thing that immediately comes to mind is we saw this in terms of how higher ed responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we were all surprised, even though maybe we shouldn't have been. So early in the pandemic in 2020, I had a group of wonderful interns who helped us conduct a landscape analysis of 24 USAID partner countries and how they responded to COVID-19. And within that work, we found higher education institutions were playing a really critical role in that community level response. So higher ed institutions were putting forward mental health hotlines, legal hotlines for the community, not just their students, but the communities that they serve to access. You know, higher ed institutions were producing PPE, were using their laboratories to produce cleaning supplies and disinfectants that were distributed to communities. So I think there's, you know, in the immediate, you know, retrospective of the last couple of years with the pandemic, there was really this great community response from higher ed institutions. Longer term, I think about programming like our University Scholars Program in Lebanon, where the students do study in Lebanon at Lebanese universities, but embedded within that is all the students have a community service component. Those students, you know, help deliver food to the elderly, help to rehabilitate areas in their hometowns. So I think, you know, that's an underutilized and underobserved aspect of higher education and the role that they can play, whether it's at the institutional level or through like students.
Very good. Central?
Yeah, Samantha, you just mentioned the strengthening of institutions, strengthening of capacity. In that context, can you talk to us about the power and the potential and possibilities of collaboration in higher education, particularly between U.S. and international institutions in addressing multifaceted challenges faced by many, many countries? And what do these institutions, both on the U.S. side and the international side, gain, you think?
Yeah. So again, I think this is really rooted in those core functions of any country's higher education system, right? And I keep coming back to the system, even though we often work at a higher ed institution level, the higher ed system in any country has to do those three core functions, right? Education and training, research and innovation, and that in community engagement piece. It may mean that higher ed institutions do all three, but maybe individual institutions may not. Maybe they just focus on the teaching and learning. And really honing in again on that network and community space, I think there's a lot of opportunity for higher ed to be contributing to some of these larger global challenges. You particularly use the word power. I think we're at a moment in time where partnerships between U.S. and international higher ed institutions are really thinking about who holds the power and how those partnerships can be formed in a way where there's more equitable shared power and decision-making. A phrase that I like to use and think about, you know, I do work for the U.S. government, so we are promoting, you know, partnerships often between U.S. institutions and our partner countries. But I like to use the phrase of thinking about how can the U.S. institution be the guide on the side rather than the sage on the stage. It's not about us saying, this is what we're doing in the U.S. and it's so great, do it exactly like we're doing. Higher ed has its own challenges in the U.S., but how can we shift that power to be more shared, more equitable? And also, how can we be thinking about what institutions can gain from both sides? You know, we're in a time where higher ed institutions and higher ed systems need to be more nimble. They need to be able to respond to local labor market needs. They are viewed as being ivory towers. There's a lot of questions about the relevancy of higher ed. And of course, in the U.S., we have huge issues around affordability of higher education. So I think partnership can be a way to think about how these relationships can go both ways, what connections can inform how we're learning from each other and how we can shift some of those, you know, power imbalances and find those opportunities for collaboration.
Thanks. Dean?
Samantha, why don't we switch gears just a little bit? I'm always fascinated where people come from and their degrees. And it isn't necessarily what you think they will be in terms of the careers that they end up. You, for example, have a degree in agriculture. And by the way, you're not our first guest to have a degree in agriculture. But in both cases, they've moved into yours in the field of government and international relations, theirs in higher education and online learning. But I am kind of curious, it's being a Midwesterner, What attracted you to agriculture and then proceeded to kind of take you outside the West or the Middle West and started looking within an international aspect? I mean, what attracted you to this international work coming from that field?
Well, I'd say if there's one common theme about, you know, whether it's my fields of study or a career path, it's that I've never taken a traditional path. And maybe also that I'm open to saying yes to opportunities. So I studied agricultural education as an undergrad. You know, I did not grow up on a farm or ranch or have connections to that within my family. I am a city girl from the suburbs of Phoenix, Arizona. But my junior high had a high school-based agriculture program with a land lab with animals. And so I was like, I'm going to take the classes where I get to play with animals. And so that brought me to 4-H and FFA, even though I was a city girl. And, you know, I showed sheep and was on this first all-female Arizona State 4-H livestock judging team. So it was just, you know, none of that was expected of me growing up where I did. And then it, you know, it kind of, I think, created a passion for education in me in all forms. So I was really lucky when I was at the University of Arizona. I had great mentors and still have great mentors that, you know, from that time, Jack Elliott, Billy Foster, James Knight, and they really encouraged me to kind of have different experiences and careers. I did not study abroad as an undergrad, but I did do my student teaching on the Tohono O'odham Native American Reservation in Southern Arizona. And reflecting back, I think that was really a spark for me to really want to learn about other cultures and try to make a difference in our work. And, you know, you don't have to go abroad to have a cultural experience. We're very diverse across the United States. That student teaching experience also taught me that I did not like high school any better as a teacher than I did as a student. So the high school classroom was not the place for me. So I stayed and did a master's, also in ag ed. I taught at the collegiate level. I really enjoyed that. And then, you know, those mentors, like, you know, Jack Elliott that I mentioned, he had in that time moved to Texas A&M. I had had a whole initial career in association management, working for a National Ag Teachers Association, as well as a trade association in the beauty industry. So, you know, a little bit of transition from agriculture there. But, you know, in that time, I'd started traveling internationally for fun. And that opportunity, when Jack suggested that I might want to pursue a PhD, really left me thinking about, okay, where can I can combine my interests? I have this personal interest in international travel. I was looking to get back into ag. You know, long story short, I did leave Texas A&M, ABD, all but dissertation. I took some jobs in the international agriculture development space, working with ACTI VOCA and later with USAID Feed the Future activity that worked in Tanzania. But both of those activities were based at African universities. And somewhere in that time, I had this transition where I realized I wasn't an ag person anymore. I was a higher ed person that happened to be working through agriculture. So yeah, that's kind of my path there. And I'd say, I think it all comes back also full circle. I myself am a first generation college graduate in my family. I've seen how transformative higher education has been in my life. And even though this was not the path I envisioned for myself, you know, at 18, when I entered higher education, I'm passionate about trying to make a difference so that all students have choice. I'm not saying that every student has to pursue higher education, but every student should have the choice to pursue higher education if they want to. And you'll also notice throughout our conversation, I don't say university. Higher education is a big variety, right? So higher education can be post-secondary, career and technical education. I often joke, if I'd gone to school to be a diesel mechanic right after high school, I'd be making way more money than I made as a nonprofit professional early in my career. It's about having options and having choice. And all students, all learners, I feel, should have that.
I think that's great. Central?
Yeah. Samantha, when we think of international development, often people seem to imagine that you deal with one problem after another problem. But I want to shift our thinking to bright spots and success stories, particularly what you have seen through higher education initiatives around the world in terms of international development. Can you share with us a couple of exemplars, whether these are about transformation of an individual or an institution or even a region, that helps people to think international development actually works?
Sure, absolutely. I really love thinking about our success stories. And I think these are also ones that you know, show that sometimes the challenge that we have in higher education is that the payoffs are not immediate and take a little bit of time. So that the first example that came to mind for me on this was an investment that USAID made in the 1990s in the Czech Republic with the Center for Economic Research and Graduate Education Economics Institute. I'm going to call it Surge EI from here on to save some space. So Surge EI was established in 1991 with the support of USAID and other donor partners like the Mellon Foundation. So the USAID contribution to that investment was about $5 million at the time. That's roughly equivalent to $10 million today. So 30 years later, Surge EI just celebrated their 30th anniversary earlier this year, I believe. So they're recognized as a center of excellence in economic education and graduate education. They're ranked at the top economic departments in the world. My notes say that they're in the top 4% of 1,000 institutions worldwide around economic graduate education. And they're really innovative. They continue to be innovative in their thinking. They have this really great teaching fellows program that has a real impact on economics education in the region. You know, as I mentioned earlier, in higher ed, faculty members often come to higher ed because they're a subject matter expert, but may not have that background in pedagogical teaching approaches. So their teaching fellows program works to provide pedagogical, professional, and financial support to both graduate students and early career faculty members. So since 2007, they've had 25,000 folks participate in that. And those are folks who have gone on to, you know, influence graduate and undergraduate level economic education across the region and around the world. We have time. I'd love to share one more ongoing great success story. Is an activity that's active now. It's called Youth Mappers. It's a USAID funded effort that has helped to establish a network across 67 countries and 320 universities. Now, this is an example of something that is specific to universities. But Youth Mappers' mission is to cultivate a generation of young leaders to create resilient communities. And they do that by mapping their world. So if you go to youthmappers.org, you can see a lot of stories and examples about how these young people who are members of these chapters across these 320 universities are transforming their local communities through GIS mapping. And they're also then gaining these skills in GIS and mapping. And I just think these are examples. This is an example of like a really, you know, small, it's a student club and organization essentially, but it's really, really transformational in the local community level impact that these students are having.
Samantha, we're coming up to our last question, and I want to address this primarily for our listeners because our constituency is half US and half the rest of the planet, and primarily in the field of higher education, probably the C-level types that are there. And always one of the practical questions they ask is, well, this is all great, and I'm really interested. So how do I get involved? Because as you know, networking within the university world is essential. And so I guess the question becomes, is how do you contact USAID? How do you collaborate? What's the process? I don't totally understand how you go through that process. Can you help guide us a little bit?
Sure. Let me maybe also divide this into two parts. So first, how do you work with USAID? And how do we work? So for USAID, our collaboration and our partner countries are driven by what we call our Country Development Cooperation Strategies, or a CDCS. So that CDCS sets very high level goals in our missions, which is our presence in our partner countries. And those CDCSs are developed in collaboration with local development partners. Those CDCSs are 5-year strategies, essentially. And you'll see that those CDCSs drive our investments in those space or in that country. So my recommendation for higher ed institutions who want to partner with USAID, whether it's a US institution or you know, around the world, is to become familiar with the strategy or strategies for the countries or regions that they're interested in working in. I'll say that you often won't see higher education specifically mentioned in these CDCSs, but you'll see that there's areas where having strong higher education systems and higher ed institutions within those systems are relevant and sometimes even, in my opinion, essential to achieving what we call development outcomes. So if we're looking at a CDCS that has a development outcome around improving health outcomes, higher ed is essential to improving health outcomes. That's where we train health workers have a whole variety, doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, researchers who work in the medical space. Also, higher ed is often where the research is conducted. So you may not see it like bam in your face, that higher ed, but there, I think I've yet to see a CDS where I can say working with higher ed in this way will help you achieve your development objectives.
So that's one thing. Just take that question a little bit. I'm not going to go further with it, but as a person who would look at grants or opportunities and things like that, don't necessarily look for the word higher education. Look for the bigger picture and how higher ed would fit into
that. Right. I mean, there are going to be funding opportunities that are specific to higher education, but there's going to be even more funding opportunities that are not specific to higher ed, but higher ed can play a role in helping to achieve those objectives. We do have something called the USAID Business Forecast. So this is a resource. If you Google USAID Business Forecast, it's a guess of what we think will be funding opportunities. So that can be a signal to higher ed institutions to start having conversations among partners. Look at the CDCS for that country and think about, you know, what kind of an approach or partnership. And then the actual funding opportunities are posted on two websites, grants.gov and sam.gov. So you'll want to keep an eye on those. That's where all of our funding opportunities are competitive. You have to, you know, submit an application or a proposal. One thing that I like to remind folks that are new to working with USAID from the higher ed space is that we are a development agency. We're not a research agency. So I often get asked, well, Samantha, why can't USA funding opportunities be more like NIH, the National Institute of Health, or NSF that funds my research? And that's the bottom line, is that we're a different type of agency. It doesn't mean that we don't use research and evidence and data to inform our decision making, but we're a development agency. So we're going to more likely be looking for on the ground implementation approaches, not necessarily, you know, funding an individual's research grant. One more resource I'd like to recommend for folks is earlier this year, USAID launched a workwithusaid.org website. It has a lot of great resources to help understand how USAID works. And there's also a great platform on workwithusaid.org to connect with others who are interested in partnering. So you can put a profile up on that website from your organization and find different ways to connect with other organizations that are working with USAID.
Very good. Yeah, would you like to bring
up? Yeah, just to say, I think the second part of your initial question was around how to forge effective partnerships or collaborations. So I can be brief on here, but as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really important for partnerships to start off with an equitable foundation, right? Looking at shared visions for the aspect of the partnership, and that includes how decisions will be made. You know, we hear a lot about institutional partnerships that are forged from people-to-people experiences, you know, people who were research collaborators or maybe participated in exchange programming that's ran by my colleagues at Department of State, like International Visitor Leadership Program, IVLP, or Fulbright. So, you know, those are relationships that can grow and become, you know, an institutional level partnership. But maybe the bottom line here is that people matter and are the heart of successful, you know, collaborations and partnerships. So making sure that there is that shared vision and equity and decision-making across the partnership is what I think makes, you know, a successful collaboration.
Excellent. Central, why don't you go ahead and lead us out?
Thank you. We'd like to thank our special guest, Dr. Samantha Alves, the Senior Advisor for Higher Education in the Center for Education at USAID, located in Washington, D.C. This concludes this episode of Higher Ed Without Borders. If you would like to comment on today's show and suggest a future guest, please go to www.higheredwithoutborders.com comment section. On behalf of Dean Hoke, Dr. Samantha Alves, Edu Alliance, and myself, thank you. And make sure to subscribe via your favorite podcast app.
Samantha, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, that's excellent.
This has been a production of Edu Alliance, an international higher education consulting firm with offices in Abu Dhabi and Bloomington, Indiana. Nathan and Hoke, along with their team of experienced professionals, have assisted universities worldwide. To learn more about Edu Alliance, go to our website, www.edualliancegroup.com. You will find details on our podcast, contact information and our services. Thank you.